Hi-de-ho, everybody. Welcome to another podcast from theoneliner.com. As always, I am Craig Eastman, and coming to you from Glasgow, as always, site editor Scott Morris.
Hello.
And site contributor Drew Tavendale is coming to us, as always, from Falkirk.
How do you do?
Four films to discuss tonight. Not a bad pick either, as it turns out, so without further ado, let's crack on. You can't have missed the pre-release hype for District 9. Director Neil Blomkamp's sci-fi race relations crossover has been a US box office hit, and its inventive marketing is currently plastered over buses and phone boxes across the land. Beginning in documentary style, District 9 chronicles the Johannesburg authorities' attempts to rehouse 1.8 million illegal immigrants from their shantytown slum to a shiny new concentration camp. That said immigrants are in fact aliens from a spacecraft that appeared over the city some 20 years ago, remaining there ever since, seems of little significance, as choosing to set such a tale in the racial powder keg that is South Africa clearly sets out the thematic stall of Blomkamp and Crowe writer Terry Tatchell. The movie follows government contractors, MNU, and their alien relations coordinator, Vikas van der Merwe, the man charged with heading the eviction notice process. Drawing all manner of comparisons with South Africa's recent political history, District 9 changes pace after Vikas becomes accidentally infected by alien genetic material that threatens to turn him into one of the so-called prawns. Should point out this at this stage for prawn substitute kaffa, I think. Thereafter, it's a race against time as Vikas struggles to keep ahead of his military pursuers and help an alien father and son return to the freedom afforded by their mothership. Certain to make stars of both Blomkamp and star Charlton Copley, does District 9 live up to the commercial and critical success it has so far enjoyed? Scott, what was your immediate impression of this?
Nonplussed and disengaged for a lot of it. I think I'll get the one criticism out of the way that I think is actually properly valid. I just don't think that this Charlton Copley is good enough to base a film on. I didn't buy him. I wasn't particularly sympathetic for him. I didn't buy into his character in the slightest. That aside, the actual structure of the film is clever. Now, when you mention things like it has gathered a lot of internet buzz and has innovative marketing, that immediately sets alarm bells ringing because that means it's sort of in the sort of snakes on a plane.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like lots of buzz. Actually, shit. It's not shit. But I think there's flaws in this film that just stops it hanging together for me. I think when it starts off with this sort of pseudo-documentary structure, that does work very well. I think that works quite well, and it sort of sells you a dummy a bit, certainly the proportional material. I was expecting something a bit more continually along those lines and something a bit more cerebral. When it sells you the dummy and turns into a chase film slash action blockbuster at the end, with CG things blinding into other CG things, that bit's fine as well. If you had the whole film like that, I'd probably enjoyed it quite a lot too. So I think there's two halves of two good films in here, but when you've slammed them together like this, I just didn't felt that it meshed, especially when it turns into, I mean, towards the end, it's just a proper feature film, except that it starts throwing in sort of documentary-style bits for no good reason at that point as well.
Yeah.
It just felt a bit confused as to what it wanted to be. It's not unenjoyable, though. I wasn't bored by any of it. I thought, for the most part, I did quite like it. However, I just feel that it's not worthy of the sort of hype and the respect that it's been garnering of late.
I have to say, I'm not quite as down on Charlton Copley as you were. I did quite enjoy his performance. But the major criticism I have of the film is that it did jar slightly that transition from the documentary style initially to the action. Well, essentially, it just becomes an action film later on, doesn't it? And this injection of talking head sequences later on that seem to be there to kind of remind you, oh, remember, this all started out as a documentary, remember? But I wasn't, again, I echo what you would say, and I didn't enjoy it as much as sort of popular opinion seems to suggest. I mean, I think it's currently riding on an 8.5 rating in IMDb, but it was an enjoyable enough way to pass the time, and it was certainly well done. Drew, what was your impression?
Much the same as both of you. And my issue with the style of it wasn't even so much that it changes at the end, it's that throughout it changes, and it, you know, the premise being that it's a pseudo-documentary, and that works quite well, it's really well done, it looks like a real documentary. And they're going along giving things in flashback and the talking heads, and then all of a sudden they'll drop into the normal narrative to let you see what's happening. Didn't know whether it was one thing or the other. And the other problem too, I didn't particularly like Charlton Copley either. But the problem is simply with his character. I mean, I guess you're supposed to feel some sort of sympathy for him, perhaps, and hope things work out for him. But he's a bit of a bastard. He's not as much of a bastard as the other people in it. But he's still a ignorant racist bastard, so why would you want him to succeed?
I found it difficult to swallow his transition from sort of the bumbling weakling who was sort of tagging along with popular opinion and who you got the impression was being racist towards these creatures purely because that's what his peers were doing. He came across as quite a weak character.
Which actually, I think, worse, but
yeah, absolutely. But then by the end of the film, we're supposed to believe that he's this power-suited badass who's just wantonly sort of blowing away various humans, albeit, can I say, with the film's strongest point, an electro bastard ray gun that blows people up.
I know, I'd have to say that's the second strongest point. My vote for strongest point goes to the pig launcher, which was awesome. It's a pig launcher.
The gravity gun, which happens to fire a pig. Well done there.
I get what you're saying. I mean, because he's rather incompetent at the beginning. He's portrayed as a bit of an idiot who's only
given the job because he's married. Yeah, exactly. Nepotism. He's married to the boss's daughter, so.
And he's a bit useless. He's not stupid, but a bit naive and a bit...
a bit weak-willed.
Ineffectual.
Yeah, just a bit incompetent. And then, yeah, he's all of a sudden this badass and his massive exoskeleton. I mean, that said, the scene where he's fighting in the exoskeleton at the end is enjoyable.
It's pretty cool.
fun, but it's got sod all to do with the rest of the film. It just doesn't fit at all.
He certainly taught those Nigerians a lesson.
In terms of just CG stuff blowing up, it does it about as well as anyone I've seen.
Considering what I could, I haven't checked, but what I can imagine the budget of this film to have been, that's especially considering the sort of handycam sort of documentary style of some of the earlier stuff and the problem that presents in integrating realistic CG into the scene, it's done absolutely seamlessly throughout. There's no point at which you look at it and you think that's, I mean, you know these creatures are CG because they can't possibly be men in suits, but you can't really pick fault with the effects work, I'll give it that.
IMDb is estimating $30 million, which, in terms of any sort of action movies, low. Is low, yeah.
Yeah, that seems almost
possibly low, actually.
The other thing is that I have to say is that I'm not entirely sure what it's trying to comment on, or what comment it's trying to make in terms of race relations, because we all know it's a bad thing, and it feels like that's been tagged in there to give it perhaps a bigger significance than it actually has.
I mean, it's obvious the parallels are drawn with apartheid, etc., and I understand like quite clearly what the similarities are, but what's it saying? It's not really got a point.
Mm. And then, see, like, after half an hour, it's like, well, that's our social conscience salve. Let's just blow shit up. Okay, yeah. Bang, boom.
It does. It stops short initially of having an alien leader locked up in a prison called Nelson Mandela. Do you know? But other than that, the sort of the parallels are very, very vividly drawn between, the only thing that South Africa is famous for, really.
But
to no real end, because as you say, by the end it turns into a shooting gallery, but a very entertaining shooting gallery at that, I have to say. So it'll be interesting to see what writing team Blomkamp and Thatcher come up with next. And I mean, I'm assuming off the back of this, he's going to be given his pick of projects. So it could be quite interesting to see what he comes up with next.
Just before we move on, I'd just like to mention too, you mentioned about it having an 8.5 rating IMDb and it's currently sitting at number 65 in our top 250. I'd like to yet again put out a plea for IMDb to ban any film from being allowed into their top 250 unless it's been out for at least a year.
Yeah.
They might actually get some valid entries in it.
And as a rating of popular opinion, I suppose IMDb is as good as the next thing, but then you have to question actually the validity of popular opinion. Because people seem to ride on a crest of hype with these things. I mean, like you say, there's no way it's anywhere inside the top 200 movies of all time, let alone
number 65. 2,000 movies of all time. It's an all right film.
That's the final word on that subject.
And that review was brought to you by Kleenex. 500 Days of Summer is one of those movies whose marketing will either immediately appeal or appall. Clearly setting out to appeal to the late teen, early 20s alternative crowd, it's the willfully hip and kooky tale of Summer Finn, a young lady who steadfastly refuses to believe in true love, and a young chap by the name of Tom Hansen who falls hopelessly head over heels for her. Zooey Deschanel and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are the couple for whom you will no doubt find either great affection or a burgeoning stomach of bile. Which is it to be? You shall have to defer to Drew and Scott. And I'm going to go to Drew, first of all.
Well, neither of those is actually right, and it's closer to being split between them, actually.
Damn it, man! Fall on one side of the fence or the other!
I'm on both sides of the fence. I'm sort of straddling the fence, which is kind of uncomfortable.
Stop behaving in a quantum way.
Yeah, the problem is I like Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and pretty much everything I've seen him in, I find him at least competent, generally very likable, with the exception, actually, of G.I. Joe, of which we spoke recently. The problem here is Zooey Deschanel. Is there something really quite unlikable about her? I guess a lot of other people might not feel the same. She's kind of spiky, kind of prickly, and a bit cold. So it's kind of hard to engage with a character like that in a romantic comedy. Well, although they claim it's not a romantic comedy, it clearly is. And that's really where it falls down. It's all right. It's not a right film. It's kind of entertaining with some funny bits in it, but you just kind of want the main female character to get slapped, which is not really promising concept for a film.
And yet you're still sitting on the fence, Drew.
At what point was I sitting on the fence?
But when you said you were sitting on the fence.
I said I was on either side of the fence or both sides of the fence. I wasn't sitting on it.
Straddling a fence, that just means you sat on the fence wrong.
But I've got strong opinions. That's not sitting on the fence, is it? Okay,
have you finished?
I can't remember, probably.
Right. Drew's probably finished. Scott, have you probably got anything to say?
To be honest, very little. I didn't not like this film. Again, it's perfectly adequate in terms of being a rom-com. As you say, I still like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I always have done, especially. I mean, anyone who starred in Brick can do no wrong for the rest of his career, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with that, yeah.
The problem with this film is just that it's kind of a bit too quirky for its own good. It's trying desperately to be a little bit off-kilter and try to appeal to a sort of slightly trendier audience. I suppose it probably does. It's certainly not bad, but the problem is I'm just not really that affected by the central story. It's a yet another tale of either unrequited love, of heartbreak, and of the tragedy that always occurs when one person loves someone more than another one does. But it's just not all that interesting at the end of the day. I mean, God, surely by this point in our lives, we've all been there and done that and several tear-stained T-shirts to go by it. So it's just not that compelling. Seeing someone else being somewhat miserable is not that compelling to me anymore.
It just makes you want to just get over it, surely.
Exactly. For a lot of it, you just feel just wanting to sort of slap people around a bit and sort of get over it. That said, it's saved somewhat by some reasonable supporting cast. It does the thing that's starting to really annoy me of having like the main character's 13-year-old younger sister be the voice of reason that somehow knows everything about everything. Some sort of wise oracle thing.
13-year-old.
Yeah, I just don't. It's like it was sort of funny once. It's getting a bit tired now. And that's sort of what the whole film feels like. It's trying desperately to be fresh, but it's just a fresh coat of paint over some very old wallpaper, and you can see it starting to flake off a bit at the sides. It's not terrible. If you've not seen too many of this sort of thing, then you'll probably like it quite a lot more than I did. And even then, as someone who seems awfully familiar with this sort of genotype, I still didn't hate it or anything. It's relatively decent, but I can't really bring myself to be particularly enthusiastic about it other than saying, yeah, it's all right.
Let's drop a bomb on it.
Boom.
I was, just before the podcast, I was speaking to Scott and I was saying that for quite some time now, I've had a crush on Zooey, and despite that, I have no desire to see this film whatsoever because I generally can't get behind the kind of character that she usually portrays. And having seen the marketing and the trailer for this one, I can confidently assert that it's probably a pile of shit. And I have no interest in seeing it whatsoever. So there you go. I'm just obviously not alternative and kooky and hip enough. But then I am 30 now. So we're all 30 now, aren't we?
We're all very old. What's an internet?
That's us. We've got our boxes picked out, so this film clearly isn't for us. The increasingly omnipresent Jude Apatow is arguably Hollywood comedy's saving grace. Not since the arrival of Jim Carrey in the early 90s has one individual dominated the genre so completely. Perhaps surprising then that, despite having countless producer credits, this is only Apatow's third film as director, his last being 2007's Knocked Up. Adam Sandler is veteran comedian George Simmons, a circuit legend who has recently been diagnosed as terminally ill. Bereft of genuine friendship, Simmons takes fledgling comedian Ira Wright, played by Apatow regular Seth Rogen, under his wing in the hope of forming a final genuine bond. Things take an unexpected turn, however, when Simmons learns he is in fact on the mend, a revelation that coincides with the return of old flame Laura, played by Leslie Mann. Now, somehow, Superbad and Pineapple Express aside, I've managed to completely dodge the Apatow avalanche. Where does this stand in his canon of work, including his producer credits, Scott?
Thankfully, it shows something of a newfound maturity, I think. The rest of the Apatow stable was in danger of becoming very, very homogenised. Not that I've seen a bad one yet. It does seem to be in very much danger of becoming very, very stale in the next couple of years. Mm. Thankfully, this shows a bit more chops to his both the writing and the direction of it. The immediate danger you've got when you think about this film is that it's called Funny People and it has Adam Sandler in it. So if you expect Adam Sandler in a funny film, you're in for a world of pain. Thankfully, it's the halfway decent actor Adam Sandler that shows up, you know, the same one that was in Punch Drunk Love a while back. It's him rather than sort of wacky, zany, crappy Adam Sandler. The plot is essentially not much more, you've already said. For the most part, it's very good. It's not, it must be said, an out-and-out comedy. It's funny in places, but it's not the sort of knockabout, super bad, knocked-up kind of style of all-out zany all the time. This is a bit more, maybe subtle's not quite the right word, but it has a bit more dramatic chops to it. George Simmons is a very damaged, deeply disturbed character for most of it. He plays the sad clown character quite well. At the same time, the film is not above just coming up with some fairly bizarre circumstances. You have George Simmons in this world being a superstar comedian, not unlike Sandler himself. It does play somewhat self-referentially with quite a lot of the characters in it. When he throws a party, it's everyone that comes to it is guys like Ray Romano and Eminem. And then you get very strange scenes like Eminem angrily shouting insults over at Ray Romano, who just looks nonplussed and baffled. And somehow all of that works in the context of this film, when it does sound just sort of deliberately obtuse when you say it out of the context of the film. It's a film that's quite, I find it quite hard to talk about this film without sort of making it sound an awful lot less funny than it actually is in places, yet at the same time it's not an out-and-out comedy. I suppose it's a delicate line. It's taking a fairly straightforward comedy, a fairly straightforward dramatic concept of someone almost dying and then becoming a better person for it in the end, but it sort of twists it fairly subtly. It places it all along the line, so it's never quite the straightforward thing you think it is. There's always some kind of twist to it. There's always some sort of comic slant to it in places where you might not expect it. The only criticism I've actually got in it is the role that they've given to Seth Rogen in this case. It's basically Seth Rogen going back to playing Seth Rogen again. For a character that's in it so much, he's quite woefully underdeveloped. This is a badly underwritten role. And even when they actually try and give him some sort of dramatic twist, dramatic imperative in there, it's sort of underplayed and just not that important. It's unfortunate because I thought Seth Rogen was coming on quite a long way when I saw the last. His character in Observe and Report is Seth Rogen not playing Seth Rogen, and he's actually quite good at not playing Seth Rogen as well. This seems like a bit of a step back for him. However, for the rest of the film, it's very enjoyable. One of the more enjoyable of the year, I would say. I have a lot of respect for Adam Sandler because he's certainly not afraid to take pot shots at himself during the course of this film. Certainly seeing some of the George Simmons's filmic output in this sort of world is not a million miles away from Sandler's himself, and he seems to take it all in good grace. And yeah, I enjoyed it wholeheartedly. I'd recommend it to anyone. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone who's just looking for straight laughs. This is a bit deeper to it, and yes, it is a bit too long. It does drag on a bit at the end, and it could have probably done with a bit of trimming, but I don't think that ruins it. I still enjoyed it quite a lot.
Not just straight laughs, Drew. Is this an evolution of the Apatow formula?
Oh, definitely. It's just a bit more grown up. And not I could watch some like Superbad and love it, but it's just nice. It's a bit more real for given values of real. It's still a film with, like, as Scott said, a very strange Eminem sequence. But there are some deeply funny moments, but there are some very touchy moments too. And it is nice that the dramatic Adam Sandler showed up as opposed to the Mr. Deeds Adam Sandler or anything like that. I don't actually have a lot more to add to what Scott said. I agree with pretty much all of it. It's a pity to see Seth Rogen seem to have taken a step back, or given a step back. But yeah, it's good. I recommend it fully. It's just, it's not as consistently funny as you might expect, especially given the title, but you have to think about it more. It's called Funny People, and it's about the people who are being funny rather than the being funny part, if that makes sense to you.
It does make sense, Drew.
Good. Yeah, it's about the people who are the funny, so play with that instead. So you imagine not going to be funny all the time. But yeah, I don't have anything else to add to that other than go see it, because it's very good.
Excellent. After her 1995 movie Strange Days met with critical and commercial failure, it was a full 7 years before Point Break director Catherine Bigelow resurfaced. Do you see what I did here? What? Wait for it. With the resolutely mediocre K-19 The Widowmaker. Sorry, is that genius or what? Your silence opts for the what decision. It was another 6 years before her next feature, The Hurt Locker, surfaced on the festival scene, and it's only now, as the summer of 2009 fades away, that cinema audiences can finally see this edge-of-the-seat tale of a US Marines bomb disposal officer working in Iraq. Little-known actor Jeremy Renner is Staff Sergeant William James, a seemingly reckless bomb disposal expert who has somehow avoided using up his quotient of 9 lives. Carrying out his work with scant regard for his own safety, James moves from device to device, disarming each in his own gung-ho style, his ice-cool veneer cracking only when he fears a young Iraqi child has met with a violent end. It's a fact well acknowledged that few male directors handle action and macho happenstance as well as Bigelow, but The Hurt Locker has seen arguably the best critical response to her work to date. Melding male bonding with equal parts nerve-wracking action and black-as-coal nihilism, is this the perfect balancing act between action and acclaim? I would certainly say so, but whether or not Drew and Scott agree with me is a different matter entirely. Scott, what say ye, sir?
Well, as I believe I said to you before the podcast, I think it's telling of how good a year we've had for films that something like this I can watch and have it not be on that top 10 list that I'm thinking of in my head for end of the year. It is very good, it's very competently produced. It's perhaps falling a bit too readily into the modern war film cliches of everything being hell and so on and so forth. Sometimes I hanker for the old days of the Dirty Dozen, just going around and shooting people and having a laugh about it. But apparently that's not what war's about.
Well, isn't that what Tarantino tried to do last month with Inglourious?
It was crap. However, there's a lot of good stuff in here. There's perhaps when I'm thinking about this film, I'm trying to sort of pick holes in it, but the holes that I'm picking are incredibly minor. You know, things like when they're establishing Renner's character as being this irresponsible is not perhaps the right term, but gung-ho cowboy mannerisms. They sort of do it once and then they do it again in the scene after it, and I thought that was really pushing it a little bit too far. I kind of got the point, but that is like about the only thing I can pick that I thought was a mistake in the film. The rest of it, there's an awful lot of good stuff, like tense sniper battles and things like that, which are just phenomenally well done. There's lots of little subplots, which by themselves don't mean a lot, but they do add up very well into characterising each of these the members of the squad and how they play off each other and how they respect each other and or otherwise towards the end of the film. I mean, I thought for about 5 minutes towards the end, it was raising itself to the level of absolute genius. Then there's about a minute after that with an incredibly ham-fisted monologue, which sort of brought it back down again. But again, I'm picking very minor flaws in a film that I did enjoy an awful lot. But I certainly heartily recommend it. I don't see too many films coming from the latest Iraqistan conflicts that are anything like as good as this film is. And certainly it gets a high recommendation from me.
I have to take issue there with the point you make of sort of continuing scenes of cementing this sort of persona that James has of being reckless and whatnot. Because for me, that it was a concern for me. I was, after so many sort of disarmaments, I was thinking to myself, yeah, you're over-egging the pudding now as pertains telling me how much of a sort of crazy, happy-go-lucky bomb disposal engineer this guy is. But then he meets, and it's only a very brief scene, but it's quite a telling one. Then he meets David Morse's character. David Morse plays a colonel in charge of a unit. And only then, when he meets that character, do you realise that actually maybe he's not such a gung-ho nut after all.
He's so good at his job.
Yeah, David Morse's character is a gung-ho idiot, clearly. And James's reaction to him, actually, at that point, there was a change in my perception of, actually, his reaction to David Morse's character tells me that he's a clever guy, and as Drew says, he is incredibly good at his job. And this sort of seeming, it turns out it's a detachment he has from the work. It's not that he has a death wish, it's a detachment he has from the danger of his work is actually perhaps what's keeping him alive, rather than an attitude he has, which is perhaps miraculous that he hasn't met his death yet. Am I the only one that perceived that?
Perhaps I'm phrasing it wrong. It's not so much him being the gung-ho man that he is, but setting up the conflict between him and the very straight-laced, sort of by-the-book Sergeant J.T. Sanborn. It's that conflict that they were just sort of like, they were trying to sort of play that against each other again, sort of. Because it was like one scene where they tried to build up and another scene where they tried to build up in exactly the same way, using exactly the same methods. And
with Sanborn shouting, stop doing that.
Stop being a dick.
Yeah.
But, like I say, I'm picking fucking minor flaws in this film at the minute, you know. don't mind me.
You mentioned the sniper battle as well, which is one of my favourite scenes of any film of recent memory, not least of all because it sees both the introduction and also the exit of Ralph Fiennes' character.
Ralph.
In Fiennes' style. Hey, if he wants to be called Ralph, I'm not going to argue with the guy. Knob end that he is. Drew, what was your take on The Hurt Locker? Because I absolutely loved it.
I don't think I liked it quite as much as you, but I did think it was very good. It's certainly something I want to see again. As I suspect I'll get a lot more of the nuance out of it in the second viewing. Mm. I think it's worth pointing out to people, though, that it's about the Iraq War, so I think it immediately makes people think it might be political.
Yeah.
And it's not, because it's not about.
Oh, it's got war. Nothing to do with politics whatsoever.
Yeah, it's not actually about the war. Where the war is irrelevant, really, other than that the soldiers have got to respond a particular way to people around them because of the nature of the conflict. But it's about the soldiers, not the reasons for going to war or the extra strategy or anything. It's about what the soldiers have to do. And that's just good, I think, because then open up a whole problem if you start making it a political thing. Other films have done that and failed. And everybody's
uniformly dreadful.
Yeah, and everybody's got their own opinion of it anyway by now. And I don't think a film would say anything that would make you think differently.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very good. It's very tense. Like the sniper scene, it's one of the most effectively tension-building films I've seen in quite some time. And it does leave you feeling quite, I hate to say the phrase because it's used so much and I've never actually really understood quite what it means, but like edge of your seat. Because there's a few bits where you're sure something's going to go wrong or something's going to explode. And in most films, if it was sort of wasn't quite so well made, it almost certainly would. It's like, he thinks it's all right, it's going to blow now. And it doesn't.
It's the only film, picking up on that point, it's the only film I've seen which put me in the mindset of how these people must feel at the time. Every time that James is in a location defusing a device and Sanborn's there on watch, his team are on watch, and they're watching everybody, and anybody in that crowd who have gathered to watch could be holding, as in one notable case early on, a mobile phone, anything that could be used as a detonator. And you find yourself thinking, anytime someone walks away and walks down an alley, you're absolutely on the edge of your seat thinking, shit, he's going for a button. And I mean, Scott, as you said earlier, that the diffusing scenes play out 2, 3, 4 times throughout the course of the film. And each time you think, I'm not going to fall for this ploy again. And each time somehow Bigelow has you on the edge of your seat thinking, fuck, this is the one where it's going to go wrong and something really bad is going to happen here.
Yeah, it does a really good job of subverting cliche in those kind of scenes. Almost every other film would have it. It's like, I've seen so many other type of films now that you would be able to tell almost to the second when something was going to happen.
Yeah,
and it doesn't in this. It's almost unbearable in some points.
It's also worth noting that I suppose in recent years, I remember since we went to see Deep Blue Sea, Drew, remember we've been discussing that the whole thing of having major players cut out of a film early and how that dispenses with your preconception of who's going to survive and whatnot. And Bigelow ups the ante on that by introducing two very well-known actors at different points in this film, both of whom exit much sooner than you much sooner than you might expect, which I haven't seen it done twice in a film before, put it that way. But also, I'd like to say it's the only film I've ever seen where the issue of people being shot at a distance is handled properly. Whether or not you believe an average Marine can pick up a Barrett Light 50 and start smacking people from a distance with it is realistic or not, doesn't matter. It's the only film I've ever seen where perhaps there'll be a scene where someone's walking along and then all of a sudden they drop to the ground and about a second and a half later you hear the gunshot.
Yeah, they did that with explosions too. It's like,
yeah, absolutely.
The problem there though is I think some people, not necessarily because they're ignorant, more just that they're conditioned by so many other films getting it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
When people, for the same reason people think the thunder and lightning is done, this it sounds like it's saying to some films, if the lightning comes first, they see the explosion first, then you hear the sound. And I just think some people actually think that's a fault with the film, that it sounds out or something.
Oh, the sound's out of sync.
It's the sort of thing, I mean, it's the same thing just with gunfire, because you're so preconditioned to it sounding like it has the bass turned up in it all the way, because, I mean, I actually fired a shotgun for the first time last week, and it doesn't sound anything like it would in, say, Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels or anything.
No, it doesn't.
It's almost disappointing in a way.
Well, at the end of the day, it's not the technicalities of it I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is the fact that it's a sign of the fact that this is a film which initially it seems to be, I mean, you would assume it was offering you something political because of the context and the setting of it. But as we've discussed, it's not at all. But what it is a film which manages a quotient of action. It manages a quotient of it treats you intelligently, and it offers you things basically without embellishment. It doesn't play up the gunfire. It doesn't play up the explosions. It just shows you what actually happens when a bomb goes off. It shows you what actually happens when someone shoots someone else from half a mile away with a rifle, and it shows you what happens when a bunch of guys are put in a situation where they have no option but to go through with some of the most dangerous choices they'll be ever forced to make, and they all handle it in absolutely different ways. And I just thought, thank God, rather than setting out to engineer something which is engineer something intelligent, Bigelow does the easiest and the most efficient thing you can do, which is lay things out and just as they are. And that's what puts you in the mindset of the people who are there. That's what makes you sit on the edge of your seat every time James goes into to defuse a bomb, is not that you're being conditioned to anything. It's just that more than any other film, you're actually experiencing probably what it would be like to be there.
Oh, as much as you can on film anyway.
Well,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. As much as you can from the comfort of a seat in Scotland. Yeah.
It's very rare that you see a film that actually makes you very glad that you're not doing that sort of job. This is definitely one of them. It shows that not anyone ever thought it would be a bunch of fun and games, but Christ, this shows the horrors of it, I guess.
And it does a really good job of just making you think about the soldiers in the position in Iraq and Afghanistan just now too. And you might see a news story that perhaps soldiers shot a civilian and that's always regrettable. But you see a film like this, you start thinking, actually, I can't believe that's not more common. The incredible stress levels they must be under when every single person could potentially be out to kill them. And boy, 99.999999% of people aren't. But so many bombs go off, so many people do get killed, that you've got to wonder, how are they not just shooting everybody they see?
Scene that probably best embodies that, Drew, is fairly early doors, so it's not to give too much away, is where James is working on a device and an Iraqi citizen drives a car through the blockade, the military blockade. Absolutely, and that's perhaps more than any other scene, immediately throws you into raises all sorts of questions, and immediately you're thinking to yourself, shit, what would I do in that situation?
Yeah, it makes you think about the citizens too. I mean, imagine that some of them just sort of being belligerent because they don't think these people should be in their country, and that's entirely valid. And then you think, well, they've been told to stop by a soldier, and like, well, it's in their country, why should they? But then you also got to think, well, maybe there's been a bit stupid. It's a man with a big gun, he would stop.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Just common sense, not because he's a US soldier or anything. It's nice to have a film that actually says, go away, have a wee think about this.
Yeah, and at the same time, it's a film in which someone utters the phrase, give me the 50 cal, or the Barrett 50 cal, I can't remember. Is it just hand me the Barrett?
The Barrett.
Give me the Barrett. Honey in my ears. Honey in my ears. So there you are, folks. That's the end of another oneliner.com podcast. Remember, you can always get in touch with us at podcast@theoneliner.com. That's all one word, the one liner. Let us know what you think. Call us names. We don't mind. It's just nice to hear from people. What are we going to be looking at next week, anybody?
We will be looking at the only cinematic instance of teabagging that I'm aware of in Gamer. And
seriously?
Other yes. films as well.
Seriously. Dorian Gray, White Out, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and possibly Creation, and maybe some other stuff.
So hopefully sometime within the next couple of weeks, teabagging and meatballs.
You can't beat it.
draw your own, oh fuck, I can't remember what I was going to say.
Implement.
Tune in. Yeah, that's it. Tune in. I have always have been Craig. I say cheerio. Scott was Scott.
I also say cheerio.
And Drew was Drew.
Just to toe the party line, I also say cheerio.
Oh, I thought you were going to just go out your way to be different there. I'm almost disappointed. Fare thee well, intrepid listeners. We'll see you again soon.
Blow your nose like it's a nose, because it is, in many respects, a nose.